Oh, yeah, I asked that.
Opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. And we are having work session this morning on Senate Bill 5527, Department of Human Resources, Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Subcommittee. You have before you this morning, as the Chair has mentioned, the budget for the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program within the Department of Human Services. I've provided to each of you at your places this morning a memo, and on the back of that memo is a one-page spreadsheet that you're familiar with by now to help us work through this budget. The Governor's recommended budget for the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs is $124,387,188 total funds, 24.1% increase over the 9901 estimated expenditures, and 17.3% higher than the current service level estimates. You might recall there were several issues that were discussed during the public hearing portion for this office. We talked about the reduction in the number of beds, residential treatment beds statewide, that being 37, 13 of those coming from a Hispanic program in Eastern Oregon, and the other 24 coming from various programs around the state. They discussed the rate restructuring that the office went through during the current biennium as a result of a budget note that was included in their budget from the 1997 legislative session. We also talked about outcome measures and the effectiveness of those outcome measures in determining the effectiveness of the treatment program. Mm-hmm. The attached spreadsheet that I provided to you are recommendations from the Legislative Fiscal Office as far as reductions, and we can go over that now. Start with the current service level. You'll see the governor's printed budget there on the top line, and then Legislative Fiscal Office has made adjustments for the PERS rate reduction, for the Attorney General rate reduction, for the reduction in long distance rates for the next biennium. In addition, the Department of Human Services provided the Legislative Fiscal Office with a reshoot plan. You've seen this in other divisions' budgets. We've made adjustments for that. That includes a correction to the Medicare or Medicaid match rate that you've heard about. In addition, there was an error made in the calculation of the Medicaid match rate change, and so that error has been corrected here. It also moves expenditures from other funds to federal funds and a slight decrease in federal funds revenue. That brings the current service level budget as adjusted to $26,888,363 general fund, $6,220,990 lottery funds. The lottery funds are used for the gambling addiction program that was transferred to this office as a result of legislation last session. The current service level is $15,557,133 other funds, and $57,348,310 federal funds.
Representative Schrader.
Chair, I recommend we adopt the current service level adjustments as proposed by the LFA.
Representative Schrader moves that we adopt the current service level budget as recommended by LFO. Is there any objections? Hearing none, approved.
Next, we go on to package 090, which is program adjustments. And in this case, those reductions you can see here on this spreadsheet are very minor. The general fund is being reduced in the governor's recommended budget by $1,125,736 general fund, we've made a slight technical adjustment to that with regards to the PERS rate adjustments. That reduction is reduced training and provider reviews from the reorganization and other savings from reorganization. This is primarily to savings that the office implemented to reduce the impact of the rate restructuring so that they would not have to cut additional beds.
Senator Duncan, since they have that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, on this spreadsheet are just the adjustments that we've made to their budget.
Right. I could see you have something different. That's what I was.
Go ahead and pass them out.
Let me provide you with these spreadsheets to give you a little more detail here.
I look down, I can see you have something different.
Madam Chair? Does the current service level budget include the $10.5 million reduction?
No.
Well, I guess my question is, if you start out with $45 million on the governor's printed budget and you increase it by $216,000, how do you get a current service level of $26 million general fund? That's not making any sense to me. Am I missing something?
Did you combine? Well, that's a question asked of Rick.
Madam Chair, the current service level budget does not include that $10.5 million.
Right, but the question, Rick, is if you start with $45,201,000 at the top with the governor's printed,
yes,
and then you take $216,000 and add it to it, how do you end up with $26,888,363 general fund?
Your the LFO recommendation is $34,918,000.
Correct. I'm not sure where you're getting that.
I'm getting it off of your memo.
This page?
Right here. Your LFO recommendation.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the general fund starts out at $45 million.
Right.
$45.2 million. Okay. These adjustments down through here, including the reduction of the $10.5 million, and these other adjustments, will bring it down to $34.9 million.
Right.
Is what the total budget is. There's some additional. There's a package in here that we haven't gotten yet. Package 301, which adds $9 million to the budget. That's included in the governor's recommended budget.
I'm just trying to see where you ended up with 26,888 for current service.
I got it. The governor's recommended budget was $20 million up. That includes the $20 million that's up.
Okay.
$10 million was the children's plan, which they knocked down here. And $10 million was an increase in.
You want to walk
an increase
through
in
that.
General services.
Do something about here.
Which is this package. Here.
Yeah.
Here.
Mr. Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the current service level budget does not include the additional $9 million that's in a package for the continuation of the expansion.
I guess, Madam Chair, in the future it's really helpful if there's the summary sheet if it's subtotal down for the current service level is also on the
page. It is reflected on that.
Yes. Rather than just the reductions to actually have the subtotal.
If you go through this worksheet that I've just handed out, you will get it illustrates that much clearer. The first, if you go behind the summary sheet and go to the next three pages, page 3 of 5, that'll show you the current service level budget and how we got there. And then the next two pages will show you the packages that are added onto that current service level budget to get to the total budget. On the bottom of page 3 of 5, you'll see the $1.1 million program reduction that I was talking about in package 090.
and then your 301 is a continuation expansion.
Right, we'll move on to that. After we've done the 09 O package.
Is that clear, Christie Crossley?
Yeah, I'm working through it, thank you.
Let's get Mr.
We need a motion for 09 O.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schrader.
I can move the subcommittee adopt LFO's 090 recommendation.
Representative Schrader moves that we adopt package 090 program reductions of 1,125,353 general fund, 1,281 other funds, and 3,108 federal funds. Is there any objection?
Next item is package 301. This is the package that will continue the expansion that was begun in the 9901 biennium. This adds $9.2 million general fund. It reduces federal funds by nearly $1 million. That is the match rate that we are losing because of the cut in the 37 beds throughout the state. We have recommended a budget note that you can see starts on the bottom of that first page of the memo that asks the Department of Administrative Services to unschedule $6 million of this money and request the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to come back to the Emergency Board 3 times during the biennium to report on the status and effectiveness of treatment programs and their contract negotiations and administration with those programs. So the Legislative Fiscal Office would recommend this package with that budget note.
Representative Carlson and then Senator Duncan.
Okay, is this the e-board expansion money or is this the JCP expansion money? This is the e-board money.
Board.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Duncan.
You just mentioned something about the governor's bed. I'm looking here. The recommended budget reduces the total number of adult residential treatment beds by 37, right? And that's supposed to save 257. Mm-hmm. Okay, now how? And we're holding to that, or are we going to try to find some way to add those back?
Madam Chair and Senator Duncan, there's a couple other budget notes that we've added here. One of those asks the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to find the funds to restore the Hispanic beds someplace in Eastern Oregon, not necessarily the program that had that, but to establish a Hispanic program in Eastern Oregon for that purpose. And they are requesting to find that within their own funds to do that.
Okay, then we're still
follow up.
And we're still short 24 treatment beds.
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, that's correct.
Is that what kind of problems that going to create for us? That's probably been told to us, but I haven't been there for that.
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, we heard testimony that would add to the wait list for treatment programs. But again, the co-chair's budget at this time does not have funding in it to restore the 24 debt.
So it could be an add back kind of a consideration.
Representative Schrader.
Chair, one of the things I'd like the committee to look at, and we discussed briefly but didn't get a lot of information on the rate increases, the per bed increases, if you will, or daily increases in provider rates, went from $30 to $100 in one biennium here. It seemed like a very large increase. I think some of that came out of an outgrowth of a study that was done to try and find out what the optimum level was, and I think my understanding is $100 is not, quote, even the optimum level. But we didn't really get into that in a large degree, and I think I agree with Senator Duncan that the 37 beds are important, and the if these programs were functioning at $30, to jump to $100 seems like maybe a bit of a windfall in one biennium, maybe we should try and get there slowly. So I guess I talk with LFO a little bit. If we were to make the rate $87 as opposed to $100, we could they could find the money within their budget to do the 37 beds. So that's an opportunity to find the money within their existing budget. Doesn't quite get them to their ideal rate of reimbursement to the providers, but it is still almost three times what they were getting before. And perhaps next biennium they could get a little bit further down the way, and we would at least make sure we have the services available for the potential clients.
Senator Duncan.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd be interested to know from our staff what the impact of that would be. It might be a logical way to go. I mean, do you know, those others are probably in jeopardy now, so you try to get the increase to keep them going. Your plan may work, but yet it may create more problems. I don't know. That's what I'd like to hear from somebody who's supposed to be an expert in those areas.
Barbara.
For the record, my name is Barbara Simaglio. I'm the administrator of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs in the Department of Human Services. If I understand your question, Senator Duncan, Madam Chair, it's what we're assessing the impact to be of the loss of 37 of the 37 beds.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the question Representative Schrader mentioned maybe going to 87 and using the additional monies to fund those beds. I guess I'm curious what the impact of that would be.
Senator Duncan, Madam Chair, certainly Representative Schrader makes a good point that if people were existing and running their programs on $30, the increase to $100 is quite substantial. Actually, we'd experienced a number of program challenges at that lower rate, which is why we proposed funding an adequate rate to have these programs be able to operate. I'm sure if we're directed to look at a different rate, that we would be able to find a way to do it. But I think the history of the alcohol and drug abuse field and the funding has been that they've always been asked to sort of squeak by and achieve abstinence and people being drug free and doing so with a real lack of resource. And I think that some of the other issues that are being raised about quality are hard to address when programs are not able to hire the level of staff with the professional qualifications that would help them achieve the kind of outcomes that we're all looking for. So I think it's a trade-off. I think we've been existing at a basic or, you know, sub-basic rate, and our attempt was to bring these services into the marketplace rate. If we're asked to do less than that, then I think we have to look at what the expectations are. We did this in conjunction with trying to help the providers move toward an outcome-based system. That is our desire as well as yours, is to show that these services are cost-effective, each and every program. And we felt the best way to do that was to pay a rate that was adequate according to a market study.
Senator Shiel.
You just mentioned a market study. What's the average in a market study of other states, and do they have these kind of outcome-based criteria? Mm-hmm. Is that the result?
Senator Shields, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the study that we did looked at a variety of treatment programs around the state. We looked at small size programs, which would be considered 12 beds, and then larger programs, which would be up to 36 beds. And we looked at the variety of costs, actual costs that would be incurred by those programs, and then looked at the range of rates. Actually, the $100 is not the optimum. It's still under the optimum. The highest level that was assessed was about $213 a day, and there was no way we felt we could go that high, certainly, but something comparable would be a hospital detox can be as much as $700 a day. So any way you look at it, I think a publicly funded treatment program is still very cost effective.
Senator Duncan.
Madam Chair, well, if I'm hearing you correctly, in your best professional judgment, we would be, assuming you can't get any additional money,
right,
you would be better to go at the higher rate and cut back on beds. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Senator Duncan, members of the committee, yes, at this time, that would be my recommendation, because I don't think we can... I think taking the lower rate would hurt everyone, whereas cutting back the beds is a hurt, but it's a hurt in some programs, and not continuing to spread the problems around the whole state system, because our goal is to build a system that can achieve the kind of outcomes that we're striving for.
Barbara, what method did you use to determine the bed distribution, number one, because I received a copy of your dollars and how it was allocated and the total amount, and it appears to me that the rural and the eastern counties were reduced more than if I looked at metropolitan Portland area. And coupled with that, it's my understanding that that counties do purchase beds from around the state. So what was looked at when you made these allocations?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we did was we looked at first our needs assessment information, which is conducted through a household survey and uses a federally determined model of measuring the need at the local level, both at the state level and county by county. So we looked at the county by county need data, and then we looked at current level of service, the number of beds that were allocated against the need. And what we found were there were areas of the state where they were better meeting the need than in other areas of the state. Now, that is strictly because of history. I don't want to tell you that there was a strategy to allocate historically the beds according to need. There wasn't. But when we went for looking at the reductions, we looked at where the need was being met and chose to take the reductions where a greater percentage of the need was being met than in the places where a lesser percentage of the need was being met. The reality is, because of the population in the valley, they had less of their need met than in the area of Eastern Oregon, where people feel that there were disproportionate cuts made in the beds. And the reason we used that methodology, we felt we needed to have some type of statewide method beyond just saying we're going to pick and choose. And we looked at about 6 different ways to do this and came up with this method after looking at a number of other ways to approach the decision.
And you.
Senator D. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Barbara, are you cutting less beds in areas where there are higher needs?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct.
I also, another question.
10-9.
I want to know, are you implementing some kind of information and referral central system where people can report vacant beds and it can be utilized in another area that has high need for use of the beds?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, at present, we do not have such a system, but at your suggestion, we have put that into our plan to look at over the coming biennium to see how we could implement something like that. We'd be happy to report back to you on that.
Follow up?
Yes, we would appreciate a progress report on how more beds are utilized. Also, you have to consider there is cost to waiting. When people are waiting to get into a bed, you have increased cost in outpatient program, and the staff just have to keep helping the client before they go back to use again. So you have to weigh there's increase in cost and it might be better use in including the residential bed.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, yes, that you're absolutely correct, because we are not allowed to turn people away. We have to offer them some type of service. And currently we have about 1,000 people on the waiting list for residential treatment.
Barbara, question. What is the current vacancy factor on any day among the beds that are being purchased? And do you know?
Madam Chair, we don't keep a daily census. We just don't have the technology available to keep that. But we could try to get that information for you. It would require us to do a poll of the providers to establish that.
And then number two, what was your, when you came up with your bed count, what was the undercount? Part of looking at the budget and asking questions and trying to figure out why everyone's coming and talking about they're receiving less and that they're having that they're being cut, the information emerged that there was an undercount when you did your bed calculations around the state. So what was the undercount?
Madam Chair, what that was a day utilization by day. So what we did was we went back to look at exactly what you're talking about, the over a period of time, how many days were the beds empty, and we were able to realize some savings on that factor, although it did not turn out to be exactly what we had expected it to be. In other words, on a par, the beds are full most of the time, and the vacancy factor is not as great as we originally thought it might be.
How much was it?
Madam Chair, I don't have those numbers right here with me. I could be able to get them for you.
See, that's important to know. Senator Duncan.
We're looking on ad backs yet.
No, you're not there yet.
Madam Chair.
I think when we get there, I'll ask.
Representative Bates.
Another figure that might be helpful to us in trying to determine the need for beds in different parts of the state would be looking at the wait list by facility and how long that wait list is for the average patient coming in. If you've got a one-week wait list in one area and a 30-day wait list in another, it gives you some idea of what your needs are for that particular area. And you can also see if you're sending people from one area to another, which didn't seem unrealistic to me, where someone needs to be treated. And that's kind of sort of basic data I would expect an agency to have and have at your fingertips. So you know you're spreading resources. You do that with mental health all the time as far as beds across the state and are constantly moving people around. It's unfortunate we have to do it, but we are very efficient that way. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to see by facility what it looks like as far as a wait list for that community.
Okay.
And that would give me a good idea of whether or not you're closing the right beds or not closing the right beds. And I would expect that'd be the most efficient way of trying to determine which beds stay open, which beds close if you decide to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we can look at that factor. I think one of the complications is because of the county contracting that there is some flexibility that we have not always been able to easily track. And I wouldn't disagree with you suggesting that we need to develop some mechanisms to do that more routinely.
Would it be helpful if this body, in its budget notes, require that the information that you receive back from the counties include the kinds of information that we're requesting here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think if you're requesting from us information that requires us to get it from others, that it's helpful to put that kind of note so that people are clear of what the expectation is.
Representative Schrader.
Senator Duncan had a good line of questions about which is the best way to go, and I'd like to have a lot of faith in what you suggested, that we should, you know, stay at the higher provider rate rather than restore those 37 beds. But the agency's track record has been a little sketchy over the last 2 years, and I guess I would like to at least see the study that was done, and at least executive summary of that. I think Senator Shields had a good point about what do other providers pay in other states. That would help me at least a little bit. And I also like to know what the status of the providers are. I mean, were they about to go under? Were there those that have been going bankrupt and unable to pursue it? If we are to go with the continue with a higher rate and cut the beds so we get better results, I guess I would like to see where you think you are now as an agency and providing these outcomes and where you hope to be. And to me, the outcome would be, quite frankly, less use of alcohol and drugs, you know, people staying cleaner compared to, and that would be a county-by-county analysis, I would assume. You provided us with a pretty good chart, I think, at one point during the hearings. And then, of course, hopefully with something, get to a budget note later on, we'll have a better way besides the self-reporting to even analyze that, but at least start with the self-reporting and get better results there. That would help the next session decide that, yeah, that was a great move going to the higher rates.
Senator Shields.
Barbara, it occurs to me as I think about some of the drug alcohol programs that I know of and that I've toured that we probably would benefit if we saw, I mean, I'm having a hard time visualizing a center that's in my head right now, and if they're getting, say, the $30 rate right now, and after this budget, all of a sudden they're at $100 a day, what are they going to be doing differently all of a sudden? I mean, you know, hello, just put some flesh on that for me.
Senator Shields, Madam Chair, I think the reality is that a number of the providers reported that they were in deficit situations, and a number of the providers have reported over time that one of their biggest difficulties is keeping quality staff. So we would see a continual transition. They would hire somebody, they'd stay, you know, a few months, a year, and then they'd move on to a higher paying job. So the reality is that the biggest problem is in the workforce. And we have a requirement in our rule that staff need to attain certification as an alcohol and drug abuse counselor. We have had a very hard time keeping certified counselors in the programs, which has led to a lot of the training issues that we've shared with you before, because we're continually having to train people to do the basic work. So what we're seeing with the rate increase is an ability to recruit and hire the level of staff that are needed in order to do this work and do it at a quality level. So the main increase in where the money is used would be in the staffing.
Madam Chair,
Thanks, Joe.
I may be off the beam here, but Representative Schrader has an idea, and if I can modify it in my head, and I'm playing a little game here, I'm thinking of a specific program that I know is paid for by the state that a parishioner is in right now, and I know that they've had a lot of staff turnover lately, exactly what you're describing. But for that program to get from where it is today to solving its problems is going to be a step-by-step process. And maybe, and this could only work one time probably, but maybe during this biennium, we have a graduated kind of thing where right now very few of those counselors and so on are certified. As they get to a level where maybe 60-70% are certified, maybe their rate ought to jump to, you know, from $30 to $60. When they get to a point where 75% are certified, maybe $80. And when they get to 100%, you know what I'm saying? And that would, A, save some of the money that Representative Schrader's talking about, and B, it would give incentives and would show us the markers along the way as to how they're getting from being programs with all these problems with certification to programs where you can have the outcomes. And that gets me back to my original question. I don't know what other states are getting for $100 a day. I don't know what kind of outcome measurements they have to compare them to us. You know? It's just an idea. I know it's complicated, and I didn't have time to
and we don't have ramifications,
but I'd like us to think about that.
Do some of the programs have a fee, and we subsidize those, Barbara?
Madam Chair, providers may establish fees on a sliding scale. They are not allowed to turn anyone away because of lack of funds, but they do often charge fees. Many of the providers also serve insurance clients, so they would have co-pays and sliding fees related to the whole population that they serve. They're not allowed to charge the health plan clients, the Medicaid clients, additional fees, but other clients may be charged on a sliding scale. And that would be established by each program. There's not a standard.
There's not a
no.
statewide standard?
No, there's not.
Is there any reason why there isn't a statewide standard?
Madam Chair, I don't know the history of that, but I know that there has never been a statewide sliding scale.
I would think that without the absence of some kind of standard, you would get a lot of confusion and variables out there in the field and implementing programs, and which could cause some confusion. Are you going to look into the issue of the 87 versus 100?
I think we
will hold that package.
Madam Chair, can I just Barbara, I'm concerned about on residential treatment beds in Jackson County. At least we have one of the only programs of its kind, or did have until you decided to cut back 10 programs on our DADS program. It provides residential treatment for fathers who have children. So the rest of the committee comes and understands where we're coming from. I want to know why those types of programs got cut at preference to other programs when their treatment seemed to be effective. And I talked to our local providers, and nobody has ever raised the issue of reimbursement.
No.
They've said we need more beds, at least in Southern Oregon. And so I'm not inclined to do something that reduces the number of beds when we had a very successful program, and I worked with the DADS program when I was in the district attorney's office to get people into that residential treatment program for single fathers a lot of the time who were trying to take responsibility, yet
that program seemed to be shut down because of its gender specificity. Can you address that?
Representative Patridge, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I don't have the page right in front of me, but from my memory, Jackson County in the 37-bed reduction, there were two beds in Jackson County. The way we did that was we asked the county to make that decision because the funding goes to the county, and then the county would make the decision on how they were going to take those bed cuts. So I'm not aware of a 10-bed reduction in that program. I'd be glad to try to find out more information on that. But again, it's part of the 37 total.
Madam Chair, Representative Patridge, I'm Tony Phipps. I'm the Deputy Director for the office. And the Barbara described the cuts for the 37 beds correctly. The DADS program is primarily funded through Services to Children and Families, and those dollars are channeled through our contract out to the counties. So the two beds that we reduce are specifically our monies. The DADS program is primarily Services to Children funds.
But do you determine the criteria for those?
No, we do not. That was agreed to between the program and SCF.
Okay. We'll talk to SCF about that.
Representative Carlson.
Okay, thank you. I'm just trying to differentiate what we're talking about here from the juvenile crime prevention money. That was the $10 million that came out of Senate Bill 555 last time, and it was supposed to have been used for alcohol and drug prevention and treatment, or intervention and treatment for kids and their families who were on the cusp of going into juvenile, and the bill included five risk factors and really pushed sort of a research-based approach to preventing juvenile crime. This was the alcohol and drug portion. Other portions went in other budgets. And in the booklet that we got, Why Should You Care About Addiction in the back, it spells out, you know, there were some parenting grants, there was some housing and community services grants, there was $750,000 that went into workforce development initiatives and client outcome surveys. Looks like part of it went into residential and treatment enhancements. And I guess I'm concerned about making sure that the dollars went to where it was intended to go, and that if we roll this forward in the next budget, that it continues to go for what it was intended to go for. So I'm trying to find out where it is in this budget analysis that we're looking at now.
Representative Carlson, members of the committee. The budget as presented, the governor's budget, does fund those programs that you see in that report, and it rolls up that amount for the coming biennium. So you're correct that those are the programs that were funded with the $10 million, and those would continue to be programs that would be funded, with the exception of places where the program for some reason wasn't able to get started. They've chosen not to continue, which is a small amount, but we would do a normal review before the contract process to make sure the programs were all operating. But we do intend to fund those.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you probably feel like you're taking a little bit of a beating this morning, but we are trying to get down to something that helps us decide what way this agency should go. I'm going to ask you a question, but I'm going to lead up to it first. I'm going to draw on some information or knowledge I have in the private sector of how we deal with drug addiction and alcohol addiction and the programs that are successful. I would start by saying that with the lack of data on your outcomes, we don't know really which of these programs are good or bad, are effective or not effective. And that's one of the issues we've had all the way through in this. Now, a lot of your outcomes are over 90 days after leaving the program or 60 days, which is a real drawback for it. It's a lot of self-determination in it, which is not helpful. You've got prevention programs in here for kids in schools. Those have always been questionable whether they're effective or not. The DARE program and others were very popular, but are they effective is another question. Programs, generally speaking, in the private sector are expensive, a lot more than $30 a day or $100 a day. They're usually inpatient for a month or two, with long-term follow-up, often up to 5 years with random drug screens all through that time. I know you can't offer that type of program with the kind of monies you have available to you. However, at the same time, is my sense, which may not, again, have good outcome data, that the best way to treat these people is a residential program with long-term follow-up care as an outpatient, and that's the best way to get the outcomes we're looking for. What concerns me, I'm asking, is this agency seems to be going in the opposite direction. You're getting more money, and you're cutting beds. And that seems to me the opposite way we should go. Senator Shields and Representative Schrader have sort of made that point, that if you're getting more money, why are we cutting residential beds, which appears to be the best way to treat, and why are we not focusing on it and keeping those beds open in any way we can, not cut beds, and look at ways of opening up more beds, not cutting beds, and maybe looking at your other programs and say, you know, is the prevention program we're spending $18 million on, or what I think that figure was $18 million for high school and kids, is that really an effective program? Makes you feel good, looks good, contact a couple hundred thousand people, but is it effective? I would question whether or not it is, whether you shouldn't really focus down on what you think is the most effective way to go. The question is, you're getting more money, why are we cutting residential beds, and do you think that's the most effective programs out there?
There's another equation in this. You know, this whole issue is causing this committee. We're grappling with how to get there when you're saying beds cuts when you raise from $30 to $100. And if I looked at your allocation based on counties, there were certainly some winners and some losers. If I took it from your 9901 to what you project for 0103, and the losing counties, if I take it per dollar, which is what I looked at rather than looking at per bed, really begins to jump out at you. And, you know, my county, Marion County, is one. You look at the eastern counties, pretty much they were all substantially reduced. Multnomah County did not take a big hit. And I wondered why, when you did your distribution, that you did not look at those kinds of factors, given that the dollar flows to counties. They then, in turn, purchase. Some of them do operate. But the bed count moving tend to have made an awful lot of confusion in the way you're distributing your dollars.
Madam Chair, I think one of the challenges with the issue of beds and Representative Bates, I'll try to sort of answer the whole thing. If you assume a level playing field, if we were starting from scratch today and building a system, it's likely that we wouldn't build it the way we are currently seeing the programs, because we know a lot more. I mean, the reality is, when we started a number of years ago with funding, it was a grant here and a grant there, and so the services exist because people successfully applied for some grants and built strong programs. But it wasn't built with a regional vision in the beginning. We just didn't have those kind of resources. So I think the struggle that we're facing right now is, how do you build a system that is regionally accessible at all levels of care, and do it moving incrementally from a historically based system to build the kind of services we need to go forward. And that's really what we're trying to do. I think some of the approaches we've taken have been successful and have helped us forward. Others have not been as successful. But our goals are the same as yours. How do we build a high-quality system that is accessible to citizens around the state? Residential treatment has traditionally been the type of service that has been considered most successful. And I think we talked about before, the number of 90 days in treatment seems to have some effect when you look at all the studies that have been done nationally. And that usually implies some inpatient treatment. The other thing we know is that where our state clients really suffer is in their follow-up, which means we have to have community-based programs that can, in fact, follow people when they're out of the residential program, if they start there, and can continue to do aftercare, whether it be connected with housing or other supports. I think what you see in the DHS reorganization is an attempt to build the kind of services around these clients, which tend to have multiple problems. So we need both. I mean, we need some intensive services when people are in crisis, and we also need good follow-up and stabilization services so people can reinforce the goals that they've achieved while they're in the residential program. I mean, there's nothing worse than to see someone go into a long-term program, stay for three months, come back out, and have no supports. So I think what we're trying for at best is a continuum of services on a regional basis. And again, I think with the reorganization planning, we're hoping that we can achieve a lot of that with partnerships, because a lot of our clients have dual diagnosis. You know, they need mental health supports as well as alcohol and drugs.
Barb, not to cut you off, but yeah. We're not going to move your package 301 this morning. What I will propose is that Representative Schrader with LFO and the agency get together to see if you cannot look at this issue, bed issue, and funding distribution, and then come back to us before we move this package. There is a lot of concern about the bed issue. So I won't move that today. We will continue to work on it and then come back before we complete the total work session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duncan.
There's nothing in that that wouldn't say they come back with the recommendation as it is right now.
Right. There's nothing to say that wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. But at least I think that, right. That there's been a lot of issues and questions raised, and those need to be worked through.
Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
I just gave a spreadsheet to Rick also of the juvenile crime prevention dollars. I asked the agency to help me figure out where the money went by general and federal funds, and I'm not sure that the rest of the committee had the opportunity to see that. But I do have some concerns about how the money was distributed, whether it was an equitable allocation. Many of the same issues that you've raised on the residential side I have on the prevention side, so I think that needs to be part of the equation as well.
Could you add that to your list, Representative Schrader?
Sure.
We will move on then to Rick.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. The next item is package 306, which is the $10.5 million general fund as part of the Oregon Children's Plan. That currently is not in the co-chair's budget and is not recommended at this time.
Madam Chair. I recommend that at this time we adopt LFO's recommendation for the co-chair's budget reduction in the children's plan, package 306. Not recommended at this time, but you can deal with it as an add back by law.
Representative Schrader moves that we accept the LFO's recommendation of the Oregon Children's Plan, which the co-chair's budget reduced, that it's not recommended at this time. We may be able to revisit it later. Any objections? Hearing none, adopted.
And then finally, there is the 1% reduction in out-of-state travel. This really is a minor adjustment, $139 general fund, $7 lottery funds, $255 other funds, and $299.
Representative Schrader.
Madam Chair, I move LFO's 1% reduction to out-of-state travel.
Representative Schrader moves that we adopt the 1% reduction of out-state travel. Any objections? Seeing none, approved.
And finally, Madam Chair, there's two additional proposed budget notes there as a result of conversations that this committee has had in the deliberations and the public hearing. First one requires the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to develop a policy regarding the use of urinalysis to confirm alcohol and drug-free status of participants in treatment programs. and it asks the office to report back to the emergency board on the development and implementation of this policy. And then the second proposed budget note, again, directs the office to restore the Hispanic residential treatment, a Hispanic residential treatment program in Eastern Oregon, and to report back to the first emergency board after discussion is concluded on the source of the reductions to what the programs would be reduced to fund this Hispanic program. Now, I don't know if you want to act on that based on the conversations we've had today or hold on that one.
I would like to continue because I think that is something that this body, regardless of what we do on the other, that there is the concern that the Hispanic program was discontinued. And I think that there, this panel, I know that I, for one, would like to see a Hispanic treatment program in the state. I would like to offer a third budget note, and I hadn't discussed it with Rick, and that's one that addresses the issue of where both alcohol and drug, mental health, and the health division are all supposed to be developing plans with respect to fetal alcohol syndrome. And so I would like to note that that the three of them should get together and to present a plan to the emergency board. And I would make that the September emergency board.
Are we going to, Madam Chair?
Senator Yee.
I have a letter from the health division regarding their suggestion how to address the issue of alcohol, fetal alcohol baby syndrome. But it's very general. I know you have discussed this with Ms. Demezio and the health, the human resources division. But the point you mentioned is very general. And that's why I think this committee needs to see a more specific plan about who's going to do it, how is it going to be done, and how can we be assured that it will be done, and what kind of results you hope to achieve, and what is the baseline data. So I would like to suggest we unschedule $1 million from their budget to make sure we have this plan before us by September. This is subject to the chair and the committee's consideration. But this show we are serious about getting information we need to have, and not just general information. And this is a very important issue,
yeah.
Not just because we are concerned with the health of the pregnant women. We're also concerned with the mental and physical health of the children. So,
Senator Yee, we are planning to schedule $6 million.
Oh, that's even better.
Is that even better? Okay.
Madam Chair?
Representative Schrader.
I'd like to move that the committee adopt the proposed budget notes, the one that talks about concerns about the self-reporting and looking at doing more urinalysis, analyzation of the participant success in the programs. Second budget note that talks about trying to restore at least a Hispanic residential treatment program in Eastern Oregon. And a third budget note that talks about alcohol and drug with mental health and the health division working together on a plan to address the fetal alcohol syndrome problem and bring it to the e-board in September.
Representative Schrader moved that we adopt the budget note that deals with self-supporting of the individuals in your analysis, and that we adopt the item number 2, that directs the Office of Alcohol and Drug to report to the first emergency board on the restoration of the Hispanic Residential Treatment Program, and number 3, budget note that deals with the plan for fetal and alcohol syndrome. Are there any objections?
About unscheduling.
It's already, we're dealing with that in package 301.
Already in 301.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Now you may go to House of Governors.
Okay.
Barbara, we had requested a one sheet performance measures. While we're discussing back the list, we can start on the add back. I know that Senator Duncan, and I will call on Senator Duncan first. And
well, Madam Chair, I was going to ask about the funding for the Youth Community Intensive Treatment Centers. I don't see, and that was that. I guess last year we increased the rate to $113, and there's a recommendation the programs go to $191. That's a $2.1 million. I just wonder, have other people talked about that one, and is that one that would be appropriate on the add back? Of course, the COLA, of course, is interesting to me, but that one.
I don't know if that's, I don't recall that one, but we'll certainly. But I think the biggest concern was the issue of the number of beds.
Well, that's, yeah.
And restoring the Hispanic residential treatment, and then the rate restructuring for the that's what you're getting to,
mm-hmm.
rate restructuring,
mm-hmm.
The residential treatment program.
Right. Yeah, the beds was and I guess we're looking at different aspects of that, so at least it's being considered.
There. Representative Carlson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure how this fits together, but if I recall, we had asked to do the whole residential, particularly youth residential, together so that we were looking at it by provider, and I think alcohol and drug, mental health, OIA, FCF, a number of them contribute to the same places. So I would want to make sure that this budget, or the parts of it that, you know, were relevant, would undergo that same analysis.
I'm sure. I guess that would probably fit right in with that one I mentioned about
right.
the intensive treatment centers, too, then.
Right.
Take a look at that.
Oregon Children's Alliance, both that group of providers, mm-hmm. and then they're probably some more.
I think probably because they're, what did we have, a 17% increase in the same thing? Senator Yee. I know that you're reviewing the outcome measures, the performance measures.
Yes. I think we, Madam Chair, we requested information on several priority issues that we would like to see. I know that under eighth grade alcohol use, your target is reduced from 25% now to 23% in 2003. Drug use, you are targeting 13% by 2003. Why is there no reduction under your eighth grade tobacco use? Currently it's 13%. Don't you expect it to reduce somewhat after 2 years, after 2 years of targeted prevention program? Can you explain that, Ms. Ignacio?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, these targets were set doing a trend analysis, looking at what data we had available about how the trends were moving, and so this was based on the fact that there hasn't been a whole lot of change in that one based on our student survey. We set these goals with a committee process, and so we'd be glad to look at revising them if that's your direction. But at this point, these had been set prior to us coming into this process.
Barbara, both you and Health Division have tobacco use as an outcome? And so do you have your data independent of the Health Division?
Actually, I just was handed something by the Health Division talking about the reduction since 1996. Whereas in 2000, which you see here, we have the rate of 13%. It has reduced dramatically since 96. In 96, the rate was 22%. So given that dramatic reduction at that time, I think we're seeing that we're at a point where we're fairly level.
Question. Do you do your data independent of the Health Division, or do you use the same data source?
Madam Chair, we do a combined school survey, and we do work with the Health Division.
Okay. So there's one data source?
Yes.
And so the 13% that's targeted for 2003 would be the same 13% that the Health Division would have?
Correct. It would be the same tobacco use.
So you're expecting it to flatten?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duncan.
I think it would be important to note, though, that one couldn't say since it's flattened, we don't need to do anything. It's probably...
I think if anything, one would expect you need to do more.
You have to keep doing it right, to maintain it there. I suppose there's a point of diminishing returns where you're finally going to get to a point where, hey, there are going to be some people smoking no matter what you do.
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, like, yes, no. Just because we're saying that it's flattening certainly doesn't imply that we're going to stop doing the work or lessen our efforts. That certainly isn't the message we want to give. We're still going to be working on this aggressively, and I think particularly the Health Division has that focal point. We've also had, after the last e-board, an additional $965,000 in enforcement efforts because of the federal SINAR requirements for enforcement of sales of tobacco to minors, which also is related to that use. So I think we're aggressively pursuing this target.
The SINAR agreement, those performance measures aren't included in these benchmarks, are they?
Madam Chair, you're correct. These have been the historical benchmarks. We do have a SINAR benchmark, but it hasn't been part of this process.
What I would suggest to you and to other agencies that you begin to develop your benchmarks and your measures that actually reflect what you are purchasing out in the community so that we can then track back what your results are. You know, the SINAR agreement is a major piece of your agency, and which includes the stings and all that. And it seemed to me that that outcome data should also so be here, as well as, you know, your client population that you serve is also adults with tobacco issues. And I would think that you would want to include how many of women who you have that you're doing alcohol treatment that also discontinue smoking. So there's some direct linkages between what you're doing in alcohol and drug and what's occurring in the Health Division. I'm just trying to get some consistency. Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I hate to keep hammering the same point home, but I'm going to do it one more time. I'm just real concerned about the data we keep getting here and trying to associate that with whether the programs we're presenting are actually being effective or not. I mean, if I really want to look at this, I'd say, what's the national average in these areas? Can you compare it to areas that don't have programs? And what's been the most effective method of, let's take tobacco, for instance. We know the most effective method of reducing tobacco use is local ordinance preventing tobacco use in workplace. It has nothing to do with your programs, as far as I know. And yet we're showing data here that indicates maybe your programs are working. We're putting a lot of money in these programs. I'm not getting back the kind of data I would need to see to say these are successful or not successful.
And if I can't tell it, I don't think you can retell it either. We do a lot of things sort of empirically that we think will help, but do they really help? We need comparative data with other programs in other states and data in states that don't have programs to see if these same drops are occurring anyway. It's very difficult for me, especially when I see anecdotally in my own practice no significant change in alcohol and drug use, and yet I see data here coming out that says maybe we're making some changes. And putting anecdotal stuff together with broad data, of course, is not appropriate. I understand that. But I'm just not getting the data here I need to say, yeah, this program works or doesn't work. And that's very important for how we spend our money. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Yee, can I impose on you to also work with the Alcohol and Drug Agency on their performance measures? What we are doing is that when we present the budget to full Ways and Means, that we're also presenting them with each agency's performance measures and their outcomes, so that the budget document will include this time your measurements. Just a second. And so for every agency, every DHS agency division that comes before us, we're asking for one sheeter, you know, that you present it with us. And Senator Yee has been the champion in this building and who has done an awful lot of work to assure that we are getting outcome measurements. And I think it's a very, very good thing, because next session when we return to this building to deal with budgets, we will begin tying budgets to what you state that you're going to accomplish the next 2 years. So, and I have talked to the agency about what you're giving to us, that you also require that kind of information back from your providers, so that you are linking your goals and objectives, or what we're going to measure here, with what you're paying for out there in the field.
I'll be, Madam Chair, to try my best, I just want to say agencies' goals should at least be better than their current performance, mm-hmm. because after all, if we put in so much money in prevention, at least they should show some results. So I believe the goal should be at least better than current performance, rather than leaving it flat, especially if agencies said you're going to pursue reduction aggressively. It doesn't show any aggressiveness if you don't show a higher goal. And I think we do need to collect better data, so we'll put this in one of the performance requirements. I have a question, Madam Chair. You're not showing us the recidivism rate in AA and alcohol and drug treatment. So we need to know how successful is the program under alcohol and drug treatment.
Mm-hmm. Senator Yee, Madam Chair, you're correct. That's not one of our current benchmarks, primarily for the reason that recidivism to treatment, in other words, someone who undergoes a treatment episode and then comes back again for more treatment, doesn't necessarily signify a failure. I think with any chronic disease, someone might need to go back for some additional treatments. And so that type of recidivism to additional treatment doesn't, in the way we define our clinical outcomes, doesn't identify a failure. Recidivism to criminal justice, for example, is often one that we use for those clients. And I think that might be one that would be very appropriate, looking at whether treatment would help someone stay out of the criminal justice system.
But Barbara, even though it takes maybe several tries, right, before a person finally gets tired of being tired,
mm-hmm.
there still are steps. I mean, if the person goes for treatment for 3 months and stays off for another 3 months before they get back in, I think it's that kind of information, mm-hmm. that this body is asking for, to simply state that it is difficult at best because it's a disease. I don't think is not adequate. You know, dollars this session, next session I think will be even scarcer. And I think you're going to have to justify when you come back to whether I'm sitting here or somebody else, the dollars that are going to be expended by this legislative session. And I just encourage agencies to really begin to get your work done these next 2 years, because these questions are going to be asked of you next session, and outcomes and what you're doing with the dollar, I think, is critical. Representative Bates, I don't think, could have said it any better when he said he is troubled that he can't see results. Senator Yee is raising the question of saying your bar needs to be raised as to what your objectives and goals are. You may not be able to reach it at 100% or 80 or 90%, but we really want to know on this body what we're paying for, because the hard choices are coming, believe me. Representative Carlson.
Well, Madam Chair, just to add on to what you're saying, if the legislature gave $10 million to this agency to help prevent juvenile crime, I would expect to see some outcomes, either on reductions of juvenile crime, some ties with county juvenile departments, perhaps reductions in behavioral referrals for the target populations in the different areas where the grants were given, as opposed to just having generically in a broad-based, broad population survey whether kids are using alcohol, tobacco, or other drugs. I would want to see program-specific outcomes for prevention as well as sort of the overall benchmark data.
I know that's what this committee is saying. And it's not just the Human Services Committee. You know, this is being asked of all of the agencies that really look at what we're paying for. Mm-hmm. Senator Shields.
Yeah, I just want to put on the record a little bit of a maybe different perspective, and maybe some of you won't agree with me totally, but, you know, we're talking a lot about recidivism, mm-hmm. yet this morning we also need to keep in mind that there's another kind of recidivism, and that's one of the county people said that 90% of people on the waiting lists fall back into alcohol use. That's a different kind of recidivism, because while they're even waiting to get into treatment, they end up falling off the wagon. You know, 90% of them. When you were talking about tobacco earlier, and you were talking about these goals and trying to get these goals lower, and may I just want to share this with you, I think we also ought to take into account whatever the tobacco companies are doing. I know a few years ago we shot Joe Camel. He's not out there anymore. You know, he was a great draw for kids. But are tobacco companies now subtly finding ways to attract more kids? Because that's going to affect whether this figure decreases or not, too. So, I mean, yeah, it's the responsibility of A&D and Health Division and so on to try to drive these rates lower, but they're being countered by a force out there with a heck of a lot more money than the state has.
Well, I think probably if you're going to go that route, then you might as well go the next step and say, you know, somehow as long as we have that legal entity out there, maybe we ought to discontinue that legal entity. I mean, you know, we talk around these issues. But we take all the dollars that those entities that we talk about to put them into preventive programs or treatment programs. And okay. Joe Camel, mm-hmm. he knows what I'm talking about. But clearly, I do also think that there are things out there that influence. But that does not deter the direction that agencies need to have their goals and objectives and need to report back to us their results.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think we're going to have to move on because we've got some other issues.
Okay, I just want to say one more thing about the performance measures. It doesn't include the performance measures of your alcohol fetal syndrome program, the success of the program. So we would like to measure that performance also.
Well, Senator, yeah, I would ask that you work with them on those elements that you would
and
like.
Staff.
And staff.
Yes.
Okay. I think we have completed as much work as we can get on the alcohol and drugs bill. So with that, I will close work session on Senate Bill 5527, open work session on Senate Bill 428. 482, I'm sorry.
Never have to budget.
Do you want a motion?
Yeah.
Pass a bill. Okay, Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Senate Bill 482 was a bill that was heard here in the subcommittee last week or a week and a half ago. This is a bill that directs the Health Division to consult with the medical community and others to develop a plan to include hepatitis A and pneumococcal conjugate immunizations to the list of required immunizations for school entry by July 1st of 2006. Senator Carter was here to testify on this bill. Representative Knope came forward at that time with an amendment. You have a copy of that amendment before you today. It has been approved by the co-chairs to be included in this bill. And so we're here at work session today to adopt the amendment and to pass the bill to full committee.
Representative Bates moves the adoption of... the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 482. That's A3 amendments to Senate Bill 482.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, no. The fiscal impact to this bill in and of itself is zero. Fiscal impact. Just to get together and plan. What the fiscal impact states in here is that if this plan is implemented by the year 2006, there are going to be costs associated with the vaccine and requiring schools to include that and checking.
So, Madam Chair, since it is at $3.8 million in 2003-2005.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, no, by 2003-2005, again, the bill in and of itself doesn't have a fiscal impact. This is just a bill that directs them to begin the planning process for this. There is the potential, I believe what the fiscal impact says is that if they start to have this vaccine or require this vaccine, they may implement that before July 1st of 2006. And if they do that, these are some estimated costs that it could result in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure what this...
The families may be able to pay for it.
And then the Simmers, able to. Simmer also, I can't even pronounce...
Senator Duncan?
What is... On the dash three, if the vaccine contains the, how do you pronounce it?
The thermosol?
No, I'm sorry, I think it has something to do with mercury.
It has to do with mercury.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
This is one of the mercury preventions. All right. Any objections?
No.
Approved. Representative Bates.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 32 to Ways and Means as amended with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Bates moves Senate Bill 482 as amended to the full Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation. Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senate, who wants to carry it to the Senate? Senator Hartung? Or Duncan wants to carry it?
Duncan wants to carry it.
Okay. We'll stand in recess for just a minute. Do not leave. We need to go find Senator Hanna.
Do not advance to go.
Do not. This is, I'm opening up the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 769. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 769 is a bill that will direct the Department of Human Services Health Division to establish a database to serve as a repository for data on diabetes occurring in Oregon children, and then make the data that's collected available to researchers and to conduct studies. It also requires physicians to report to the health division when they begin treating a child for diabetes. And then it also has the schools report children with diabetes to the health division. The bill is effective January 1st, 2002. There is a slight fiscal impact to this. There has been amendments proposed. You have a copy of the amendment in front of you that inserts at the beginning of the bill, subject to available funding, including gifts, grants, or donations.
Senator Hunt.
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to
Thank you.
To our Subcommittee on Human Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you have anything you'd like to
say? I would rather call up my other part of my family and...
Welcome, Dixie, the part of the family that just does all this work.
Well, thank you very much. Do you want any dinner tonight?
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, does that go for all of us?
I'm sure she could arrange that.
Well, I'm Dixie Hannon, legislative aide to the gentleman on the end of the chair here, and just bringing to you Senate Bill 769. It's a wonderful bill. It has had no opposition other than the health division being very, very cooperative, needs a little bit of funding. And right now, we'd like to just go ahead and get the bill passed as it is with the amendments, which simply adds to the bill, subject to available funding, including gifts, grants, and donations. Diabetes is an incredible disease, and juvenile diabetes is certainly a horrible thing for children to have. And as you all know, our little granddaughter, who is 7, was diagnosed with diabetes at the age of 2 years old. And at this point, there is no answer and no cure for diabetes. And the purpose of Senate Bill 769 is to have information sent to one locale, that being the health division, information that can be gathered on all children in Oregon who have been diagnosed with diabetes. And the schools would be partly responsible for that. Physicians would be partly responsible for that. And together, the information would go to the health division, not as the mandated registry, but as a repository for researchers who can use that information to hopefully come up with some kind of a cure. I know that we're getting close. We're getting very close, and that is real exciting to be, not only for juvenile diabetes, but for adult onset diabetes as well. For some strange reason, unknown to even those in the medical profession that deal with juvenile diabetes, the adult diabetes is on the rise in kids. Part of that might be because we have more overweight children. Part of that might be because our kids are not quite as, I guess, energetic and playing outdoors as they used to be, sit more in front of the television, in front of Nintendo games. But there's more juvenile diabetes and adult onset diabetes in kids on the West Coast than anywhere in the United States. It's important to have this information to for researchers to try and distinguish why this is happening. The physicians are happy with the bill. I've got letters of support from OMA, from our congressional folks that represent Oregon. So the health division supports the bill. They just need a little bit of money to make sure that it's adequate, that they can do the job adequately. So right now, 769 is a good bill. It's important for Oregon. It's important for kids. And I hope that you will accept the amendments and pass it out to full Ways and Means.
Senator Herta.
Madam Chairman, thank you, Dixie, and thank you, Lynn, for bringing this bill forward. As you know, Beverly and I lost our only son, 48 years old, 3 months ago. He had battled juvenile diabetes for over 20 years, and as you said, that is truly a cruel disease. Right. And I'm looking at Ken Strobeck back there. He has a 10-year-old daughter who has been juvenile diabetic, and boy, I tell you, when those kids need insulin 2, 3, 4 times a day, mm-hmm. it really is a horrendous thing to happen to any family, in this particular for the children. So I heartily endorse this bill, and thank you again for being here.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Dixie. I think that probably I have a brother who was a diabetic back too, so I think that it impacts an awful lot of lives.
It does. In fact, until our daughter, or granddaughter, was diagnosed juvenile diabetes, other than Senator Hannon's side of the family, most of whom had adult diabetes, we had not a clue as to how many children are affected. And it's a pretty incredible thing. Dr. Jim Hansen in Portland, who did testify at the Human Services Committee, his sole practice is juvenile diabetes, and he has about 1,000 young patients who come to him from Oregon, Alaska, Idaho, Utah, from all over. But it is a disease that is growing, and we need to know why.
Hi, Dixie. Thanks for bringing this forward. We do appreciate it. And as a physician, we consider diabetes one of the big three. Big three is the illnesses we see the most often mm-hmm. and have the most devastating effects. And especially for type 1 diabetes, which is juvenile onset diabetes, it's just a devastating disease. It affects the entire family, as you know.
It does, certainly.
You constantly have to monitor kids. And these kids, just get insulin 3 or 4 times a day. They have to have their blood levels checked 3 or 4 times a day. And even with the best of care, these will have shortened lives. And we do have a strange thing going on, and we're not sure it's just diet and activity causing increase in type 1. There may be other factors involved. And you know, as I do, that we have a chance here in the next 10 years to be able to stop type 1 and maybe even type 2 with beta cell transplants. And so yep. That's on the horizon, and we're hoping to get it.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah, it is.
It really is.
This type of a program will help us look at the epidemiology of this and find out why we're having such an increase in this, because we can't really explain it right now. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward.
You're very welcome.
I would heartily support this, and I think we should move this forward quickly.
Senator Hannon, you have...
Yes, Madam Chair, I just want to thank my wife for the comments, because the good senator from Albany will remember our granddaughter that was here a few weeks ago. That was Grace. And Grace is the one that is the diabetic, and she's a very big girl for 6 years old. She gives herself her own shots, and we're real proud of her. And this is kind of a bill for Grace and a lot of other young people. And the good senator from Washington County, I thank him for his comments, and the good doctor from Eagle Point, I thank him for his comments as well. And we don't always know why things happen, but things do. They have a reason, and so I would encourage the support of the committee.
There's one, there's a granddaughter named Grace. I'll do anything to
support that. Senator Hartung moves.
Yes.
Dash three amendments.
This is Senate Bill 769.
Is there any objection? None?
I move the amended Senate Bill 769 to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hartung moves Senate Bill 769 as amended to full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? None. Senator Hannan, would you like to carry this?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Well, good work this morning. Thank all of you. See you bright and early tomorrow at 8 a.m. If there's no further discussion, we are adjourned.